Hello, I'm Kate Gibbeau. Welcome to SITREP, your weekly look at the big issues in defence and world affairs. We're seeing signs and hearing word from Ukraine that Russia is trying to make a fresh breakthrough.
The Russians have kept a lot of troops and armoured vehicles in reserve here. So they were saying effectively, we think that they're getting ready for a much bigger push.
Mike has been talking to his sources and tracking the evidence. He'll explain what it all points to. RAF planes have flown over war-ravaged Gaza to drop tons of aid for millions facing famine. We hear how it's done and how hard it is to get right.
You've got 40 tons of aid moving increasingly quickly backwards through the aircraft, and that will cause the aircraft to pitch up. You've got to keep out of the way of it. The back end of the aircraft is open.
And has the unexplained Havana syndrome been explained, or its mystery deepened with a possible link to the Salisbury nerve agent attacks?
You know, this does sound all a bit sort of James Bondy, but actually this is the way that the Russian Secret Service operate.
SITREP with Kate Gibbeau and Professor Michael Clark.
So, Mike, you've been working for a little while on several different threads of information from Ukraine, and they're coming together now. What do they point to?
Yeah, I mean, they don't point to a big strategic offensive, because we know the Russians can't really launch one like that until probably the spring of next year. But they do point to the fact that the Russians see an opportunity at the moment. So they've been stockpiling equipment and bringing forward a lot of stuff all the way around the front. So the front is 600 miles long, 1,000 kilometres, and it looks as if they're trying to push all the way along the front all at once. Because I think they've seen the opportunity that the Ukrainians are running low on ammunition, and even if the West responded now, which they're not going to, but even if they did respond now, they wouldn't get the ammunition that the Ukrainians really need there for at least two or three more months. So the Russians are hoping, I think, that they can put the Ukrainians under pressure, and that pressure will pay off politically in Kyiv with a change of mindset. I think that's what it's really all about.
And what form do you think this new Russian push is going to take then?
I think it'll take a series of local offensives, armoured thrusts. There have already been a couple which have been very disastrous for the Russians. They're still pushing tanks forward without very much support or much combined arms operations. And we know that they are now using troops in two different ways. I mean, one is they're using their disposable troops, and they just talk of them as disposable troops, the mobiks, the people are sending to the front with just a month or a couple of months combat training. And they push those forward as it were, sacrificing them to Ukrainian fire so that they can work out where the Ukrainian firing positions are. And then they push their better troops and their artillery onto those Ukrainian firing positions. So they sacrifice their disposable troops to locate Ukrainian positions. Then they attack the Ukrainian positions. That's the pattern of it. It means huge losses for small gains. But they obviously calculate that if they can make small gains all around the front, it will somehow pay off.
Well, you're not the only one who thinks this new Russian push is coming. Journalist Tom Much from Byline Times has just visited Ukrainian troops close to the front line at Kupiansk.
One thing that we did hear in Kupiansk when we spoke to some of the people who were sort of Ukrainian, slightly higher ranking, like in the officer command, is that they were saying, look, the Russians have kept a lot of troops and armoured vehicles in reserve here. Bear in mind, this trip was about 3 weeks ago now. So they were saying effectively, you know, we think that they're getting ready for a much bigger push. Now, the thing is that the weather in Ukraine over the last month or so hasn't been great. You know, the grounds are muddy, but we're just getting to the season now where the grounds are firming out and hardening, and that if you wanted to make any mechanized push, you really could. So, you know, we know that the Russians have been keeping a lot of, soldiers and vehicles in reserve. We know the Ukrainians have spent the last couple of months sort of digging trenches and laying down barbed wire and dragon's teeth and what have you, as if their lives depend on it, which I guess they do. And so everyone is expecting that over about the next month or so, we might not see, you know, a huge Russian offensive on all parts of the front, but we're probably at the very, very least going to see a new wave of localized offensives.
And you write about the situation being serious but not dire, that there is time to turn it around. If there is a big new push over the next few weeks, can the Ukrainians hold reasonably firm?
So in the piece that you're referencing, I basically give the example of what happened when we went out on this embed. It was with an artillery unit. It was between 5 to 10 kilometers from Russian lines, is what I'll say. And basically about an hour before we arrived, they got a new delivery of shells. And what happened is that the Russians conducted an assault, not an offensive, like just a small sort of assault of the kind that they do, you know, every couple of days on a series of Ukrainian positions, you know, again, about, you know, 4 to 8 kilometers from us. And the gun that normally they say can only fire a couple of times a day, they just banged out about 10 to 12 shots right in front of us in about half an hour. It was actually, you know, it was quite cool to watch. And they sort of turned around to us and they were like, look, this is what we can do when we have all the shells. We stop them in their tracks. This is really the only thing that we need to keep going.
And what about when you left? Did they have any shells left then?
Yeah, they did have shells left, but I mean, I remember having a little look in their storerooms, and they weren't exactly, you know, jam-packed full of stuff, if you know what I mean. They have to keep a small reserve on hand just in case something really serious or catastrophic does happen.
Tom Much in Ukraine there. Mike, Ukraine's not just sitting back and waiting here, is it?
No, and it's got a big tactical decision to make. You see, they, you know, they've got some artillery. They're not run out of shells altogether. But their argument is, or their decision is, if they think that Western ammunition will arrive in quantity quite soon, then they'll bring all their stocks forward and use them to hold this Russian push. But if they're not confident that Western artillery will arrive soon, then they're going to have to keep on rationing their stocks. And that means that they'll just lose ground as gradually as they can. So their desperate calculation is, do we bring it all forward now and use it, and we can stop the Russians in their tracks, but then we're empty, or do we preserve it because we don't really think the Western ammunition is going to arrive in time? Big problem.
And when you hear about Ukrainian troops living hand to mouth with basic ammunition, what's the likelihood they can stand firm in the face of a new Russian push?
Well, they're going into static defences, as Tom said, so barbed wire, trenches, dragon's teeth, anti-tank ditches and so on. And in static defence, they can probably do okay, but static defence means that they'll keep having to pull back and pull back and pull back if the Russians keep on pushing. So they will lose territory doing that, but they hope that they won't lose too much. The problem is, you know, how does that translate politically? You know, the outside world sees a relatively small withdrawal and says this is the decisive breakthrough. It never is. But politically, if it looks like a decisive breakthrough, that can affect the way the outside world thinks about the war, and indeed the way Kiev may start to think about the war. That's their problem.
And let's just bring in another piece of the jigsaw you've been piecing together. You mentioned to us this week that Ukraine's trying to influence where Russia puts its effort and resources.
Yes. One of the perspectives is that the Ukrainians have been pushing against Belgorod, which is on the Russian side of the border, of course. It's always quite vulnerable. It's only about 30 or 40 miles from Kharkiv, the second city. And they were, you know, they were just almost like sister communities until the war began. Lots of people went back and forth between the two. And my own analysis, for what it's worth, is that the Ukrainians have been trying to prod the Russians by attacking them in Western Russia, by making people in Belgorod and Rostov-on-Don feel insecure, if anything, to encourage the Russians to try to attack in that area, because that's where the Ukrainians probably will be able to do better defending rather than move around, as I said, in the south. I mean, if the Russians attack in Zaporizhia or Dnipro, and if they were to take one or both of those places, then the Ukrainians would be in some serious trouble tactically. So that's what I would do if I was a Russian commander. But I think the Ukrainians are trying to goad the Russians into concentrating on the north and the east of the front line in order to reassure their good citizens around Belgorod and Rostov that actually the Russians are not vulnerable to Ukrainian attacks.
Okay, let's get the maps out. Where should we be watching, both to see this new Russian push starting, but also the most important indicators of how it's going?
Yeah, the big difference is between the north and the east on the one hand and the south on the other. So in the north and the east, the Russians look as if they would like to push towards Kupiansk and take back a lot of the ground that they lost in Kharkiv in the autumn of 2022, you know, when the Ukrainians launched that surprise offensive and drove the Russians out to the other side of the Oskil River. the Russians would like to take that back. And if they could take that back and grab Kharkiv, the second city, that would feel like a big victory for them. The Ukrainians have got a fair chance of defending, though, in the north, because they're in better position to do it. But if the Russians push in the south, particularly Dnipro and Zaporizhia, if they push in the south where Ukrainian units are more exhausted, they've had a really hard time, if the Russians took Dnipro and Zaporizhia, it would look as if they were able to run up the Dniester River all the way to Kiev. So the war would suddenly start to look decisively different. So by and large, the Ukrainians would prefer to defend in the north and the east and not have to defend too hard in the south. The Russians may or may not think the same, and may or may not be able to do what they really want in the south. But if I was a Russian commander, I would attack in the south.
Well, of course, a new Russian push doesn't mean a return to fighting on Ukraine's front lines. It never stopped. And while it's not often in our headlines, it has dominated the lives of Ukrainians every day for more than 2 years. So we wanted to catch up with Irina Sisak, a journalist in Kyiv for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, who we spoke to last year. She's been sharing her thoughts about the possibility of a new Russian push.
Russia never stopped pushing. Taking all these 2 years of full-scale war, there was no days that Russia didn't push and didn't try to catch Ukrainian territories. So it's just current situation. But I want to emphasize on that moment that whether Russia will succeed or whether it will fail, depends on the military help to Ukraine and whether Ukraine will have ammunition and weapons to defend itself. So Russia sees that Ukraine is in very hard conditions. Yes, we don't have enough ammunition. We have problems with military aid. So in these conditions, Russia, as can be assumed, see this situation and try to push harder at that moment.
And what sense do you get talking to your many colleagues reporting from the front line about what is happening where they are right now? Is it changing at all?
Yes, you know, there are a lot of information about attacks of a Russian army. Mechanized battalion, for example, was attacking on Avdiivka direction. It is the hottest direction now in Russian-Ukraine war. And they used 36 tanks and 12 infantry fighting vehicles. Ukrainian army managed to stop them, but we see such attacks in different directions.
And what do you expect Ukraine's next step to be?
I don't know. We don't hear now about, for example, counteroffensive as it was the previous year. Yes, now Ukrainian authorities just don't talk about it. Our president, Volodymyr Zelensky, the other days mentioned that they are expecting a big full-scale attack, yes, in 2 months, in May or in June. The mood in the country is very different because people now understand that we are already entering the phase of a protracted war. Because, for example, comparing the situation in 2023, it was more optimistic. People believed more in victory, in a counteroffensive, but when it didn't happen, and Ukraine started its third year of full-scale war, people started to feel a little bit, I don't know, despair, yes. And you don't have an understanding what will be the next one, and you couldn't plan anything.
The resolve of Ukrainians has been really, really tested over the past 2 years. How is it holding up?
Yes, you know, people are very tired of war. And they are resilient, but for example, talking about military, about soldiers, they are very exhausted. on the front line, because we have a lack of people in the army, so they don't have time to have a rest, to sleep, for example, because they have to do their combat work every day, because there is no people to change them. And soldiers on the front line are waiting for this law, mobilization law, which will give them hope that in 2 months, 3 months, someone will come and change them. So it is like this.
And how about you? How are you doing?
How me? Thank you. I'm well. Last few weeks were just a little bit nervous because we had few attacks, yes, on the capital, on Kyiv. But our air defense is very strong. Here I must say thank you our partners who provided air defense systems, and all the rockets, all the missiles were shot down by our air defense forces. But Russia changed its strategy and understand that they cannot penetrate Ukrainian Kyiv air defense, and they just bombing, they are just shelling other regions of Ukraine, I mean eastern regions and south regions, which are suffering from this shelling almost every day. And also Russia is bombing our critical infrastructure. Most of it is already destroyed.
Irina Sisak, I hope you keep well. Thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Mike, every time we talk to Irina or one of her colleagues, the strongest message is the appeal for vital military supplies. NATO's talking about a new $100 billion five-year fund, but it's only talked so far and it's not going to help right now, is it?
No, the Secretary General, Stoltenberg, is talking about it now in Brussels in the foreign ministers and meeting. And he'll take it to the summit in Washington in July as a proposal. But it's going to be, if they agree it, it's $100 billion over 5 years. And it's not really clear how that will be distributed and whether, in fact, he can get it agreed, because countries like Hungary will try to prevent it being agreed for all sorts of reasons that we've talked about many times. And if they do agree it, when does it start? Maybe sometime in the autumn. So 20 billion of the 100 billion may be delivered before the end of this year. But as Irina was saying, the needs of Ukraine are now. I mean, the question will be, is Ukraine still in the war by the autumn? Are they still able to keep on fighting? Because their shortages are now very acute. They haven't had a significant ammunition delivery since December. And they're just about to start on the main campaigning season as the weather improves.
Well, there's more perspective from Ukraine in an extra edition of the SITREP podcast. You heard earlier from Tom Much. He's been telling me about the mood among troops he met on his recent frontline visit and how he witnessed their use of drones trying to make up for shortages of artillery shells. That's online now. Next, after 6 months of war in Gaza, the many threats to life now include famine. The World Food Programme says more than 2 million people face extreme food insecurity. Aid convoys over land are mostly blocked. Efforts are underway to create a temporary landing facility for ships, but that's still weeks away. And so the Royal Air Force has begun airdrops into Gaza, pallets loaded with tons of aid, including rice, tinned food, baby formula and clean water, dropped with a parachute from the back of an A400M Atlas. It's a tiny fraction of what's needed and not without its risks. It is perhaps a sign of how desperate times are that desperate measures are being taken. But how do you airdrop aid like that with the best chance of it reaching those in need and saving lives without harming them? Retired Air Vice Marshal Sean Bell has seen RAF airdrops firsthand from the back of a Hercules.
airdrops themselves for the crew are quite dynamic. You're in the back of an aircraft. Generally, most of us are used to flying in civilian airlines. You all sit quietly. They worry about the center of gravity, making sure that the aerodynamics of the aircraft will work. But of course, when you're dealing with an airdrop, you've got all of this aid, often up to 40 tons of aid, that's now going to move backwards through the aircraft and therefore move the center of gravity back through the aircraft. And that will cause the aircraft to pitch up. And therefore, there's a pretty big aerodynamic load that has to be managed by the pilot. And of course, as soon as it all falls out of the aircraft is considerably lighter. And therefore, that just the flying dynamics are different. So from the pilot's perspective, it's quite dynamic. And for the people in the back, you've got 40 tons of aid that's moving increasingly quickly backwards through the aircraft. You've got to keep out of the way of it. All the crew at the back are shackled into the aircraft, but the back end of the aircraft is open, so it's quite noisy. There's quite a lot of air moving around, and now this big load of aid is shuffling out the back. So it is a very dynamic environment, both for the air crew and all the engineers and operators at the back.
So how do you plan and execute an airdrop? I'm guessing it's not as simple as putting stuff in a plane and pushing it out. I mean, you've already described about the way it affects the plane when you're actually pushing it out. But, you know, how do you make sure that it gets over the right spot as well, for example?
Yeah, one of the tricks about airdrops, and it's worth probably setting some context, because we're talking about these because of Gaza, and it's not the ideal thing for Gaza. But if you've got some remote African country or some communities that literally are hundreds of miles away from civilization, they need aid urgently, airdrops are fantastic because you can get a significant quantity of aid pretty quickly to them, and it's pretty safe, and therefore you can get food, medical supplies quickly. Now, you can drop airdrops from a variety of different heights. The more accurate you can be, you want to be a little bit lower, because then the parachutes don't float around in the air too much, because inevitably on a 20 mile an hour wind day, which is a standard windy day, the load moves a mile every 3 minutes, so you don't want to be under the parachute too long. So ideally you'd be nice and low to deliver the aid. You can, with modern technology, you can actually have GPS-guided parachutes. So you can drop aid from 20,000 feet, and the parachute flies itself to the target. But those are quite expensive, and they are a bit niche. So all of the planning is done is trying to look at where's the safe area. The challenge, of course, when you're talking about doing this into somewhere like Gaza, one of the most intensely populated parts of the world, is how on earth do you plan to get that aid in there so it doesn't drop on top of buildings, doesn't kill people on the way down, but also doesn't go into the ocean. And I think you've seen quite a lot of the aid being dropped on the beaches in an effort to try to minimise the damage to people.
And how do you do that? How do you make sure that you don't actually unintentionally kill people in the process?
So one of the reasons I think that airdrops are not the ideal solution for Gaza, it's worth just unpacking a bit. Before the 7th of October, Gaza needed 500 truckloads of aid a day. Now, for all sorts of reasons, which we don't need to get into now, it's struggling to get across into Gaza itself. One of the routes is via maritime. The US are about to build Mulberry Harbours to make that happen, but that'll take some time. And given the devastating consequences of the humanitarian crisis, international community are trying to do airdrops. The challenge, as we've seen, is first of all, each of the Hercules, although it looks like a lot of aid, it delivers about one truckload of aid per airdrop. So it delivers about 0.2% of the daily need of Gaza per aircraft, barely touching the sides of what the need is. Secondly, of course, for it is a war zone, so it's quite dangerous for the aircraft to fly low. So they want to be flying as high as possible to protect the crew. But the danger is that will mean the aid will get land all over the place. Thirdly, as we've seen, a lot of the aid that's been delivered over the beaches has landed in the water, therefore it doesn't find its way safely. There's also some horrifying pictures of some of the aid getting very close to people. There were reports that 5 people had been killed by airdrops. I can't verify that, but undoubtedly it is quite dangerous when you drop it that close to people. And of course, it's indiscriminate, because actually you want aid to get to the people who need it most. The fighting on the beaches to try and get their hands on that available aid. So you have to conclude that in places like Gaza, this is much more a political statement than it is actually delivering aid that's required, because it doesn't touch the surface, but it shows the international community is able to bypass Prime Minister Netanyahu, deliver aid directly to the community, but in tiny quantities.
Yes, and seeing some of the footage from inside the planes, it doesn't look entirely risk-free up there. And you described about the efforts to get in the right place at the right time, thousands of feet up, people moving about, heavy cargo rolling fast. I mean, it does sound, you described it as dynamic. It actually sounds really quite risky.
Well, yes, but bear in mind, you've got professional crews there that they practice, rehearse this. They know what they're doing. They're very well trained. I think the one thing that would worry me as a military guy doing it is you're flying over a war zone, and the dark shadow of Iran and the support to Hamas, it overlays all of this. And it's a complicated situation politically. And therefore, I wouldn't be at all surprised if, one of the agendas of Hamas might be to suddenly shoot one of these big aircraft out of the skies. And of course, if you're delivering aid, you're going to be flying relatively slowly, relatively low, in order to get the aid out as accurately as you can. It's a big old aircraft, and therefore makes itself vulnerable. And that's, I think, where I would be most concerned if I was one of the crews, because whilst you're not expecting to be shot at in such a dynamic environment, there's always the risk that that might happen.
Sean Bell, good to talk to you. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Mike, there are also aid efforts on the ground highlighted by the deaths of 7 Western aid workers, including 3 British veterans, in an airstrike, which Israel says was a mistake. It's almost incongruous that amid so much human suffering, it is this incident that seems to have brought one of the loudest Western diplomatic responses, at least one of the loudest since the Hamas killings and kidnappings that led to this war. Could this prove to be a tipping point?
Yeah, I mean, we say this every couple of weeks, don't we? With every new outrage by Hamas or by the IDF, we say this might be the tipping point, and maybe it will, maybe there'll be something else in another couple of weeks' time. But this one is different, and it isn't just the hypocrisy of the West saying, well, now Western individuals have been killed. It's not quite that. It is more the case that this absolutely was the deliberate targeting of aid officials on an aid operation that the IDF knew about. I mean, the IDF have failed on 4 grounds here, legal grounds. I mean, one is this a legitimate target? That's the first question. Second question, have you taken sufficient care of civilians in targeting this particular target? Third question is this the only way to deal with the problem? And fourth question is the target so important as to be worth it? Is it proportionate? And the answer looks like no on all of those things. Mm. I mean, if the Israelis thought that there was a terrorist in that convoy, then the obvious thing is stop the convoy. The place is full of IDF troops. So set up a roadblock, stop the convoy and investigate it. And if somebody in the convoy starts to shoot them. It's very clear rules of engagement. So this was not the only way to do it. And the fact that the Israelis have been so careless, so apparently oblivious to the international rules, and this is the World Food Kitchen, remember, is their approved organization. They don't like UNRWA for all sorts of reasons that go back into their history. And they approve of this aid organization, and yet they clearly, clearly targeted what they knew were 3 cars in which there may or may not have been one of the Hamas people that they were after. So I think this may become a tipping point because it exposes the carelessness with which they've conducted this operation. I think the whole IDF operation is now falling into a sort of an incoherence, which is partly driven from the top, from the political top, but partly because the IDF are not being given clear enough rules of engagement. And I think their level of discipline at unit level is simply not good enough. They're trying to do a very difficult thing in Gaza, and they're not doing it very well.
I'm sure there's going to be plenty of updates on this story as it develops and the reaction to it. Thank you, Mike. Now, we've spoken a few times over the last few years about Havana syndrome. From mystery headaches and dizziness to intense sounds and ear pain that have affected US diplomats and spies around the world. The most recent report is of a senior defense official being affected at last year's NATO summit in Lithuania. The theories range from directed energy weapons to mass hysteria. There have been no definitive answers. But now, a new journalist-led investigation from The Insider, Der Spiegel and 60 Minutes has claimed a link to the Salisbury nerve agent poisonings of 2018. Mike, what's this investigation turned up exactly?
Well, it's turned up the idea that there's a unit called Unit 29155, which is a GRU unit, which is military intelligence, that has been experimenting with directed energy weapons, meaning weapons that work both with acoustics, they're non-lethal acoustics, and they work with both sound and radio frequencies. And they've been experimenting with it. And they've produced a lot of circumstantial evidence, strong circumstantial evidence, because the people who reported symptoms in Havana were all FBI or CIA people. They were all senior. They were all working on Russia. And I think one of the most convincing points that I read is that these people were all high flyers who were used to pressure. They were used to working in a high octane way. And yet they all reported these very sickening symptoms of headaches and nausea and feeling like they had flu or something like it. And these are people who don't go off work very often because that's the sort of caliber of these top people. And then there were reports that it has happened elsewhere in the world. So it's not definitive, but it's strongly circumstantial. I think that's what the evidence so far that has been turned up seems to indicate. But the American government are not changing their view. They say they still keep it under review. They originally said they didn't think a foreign power was behind it. That is still their official position, but the finger does point towards the GRU and this Unit 29155, which are quite famous in their own way.
Well, that Russian military intelligence unit is well known to Hamish de Breton Gordon, former commanding officer of the UK's Joint Chemical, Biological, Radiological and Nuclear Regiment.
They are a very interesting bunch of people, variously described as a sabotage unit or assassination unit linked to many incidents. I expect the ones that people will know most of is the Salisbury poisoning attack. They've also had their fingers in a bunch of other incidents. Bizarrely, they were quite sort of heavily involved in COVID, and one doesn't really know why, except for the fact that their operatives seem to have some sort of background in CBRN, chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear type of stuff. And of course, you know, we're now looking at the Havana Syndrome report, which has their delicate fingers all over it.
And this journalist-led investigation says it has linked operatives from the unit to numerous times and places around the world where US personnel have reported symptoms known as Havana Syndrome. What do you make of that?
Well, it's a fascinating report. You know, perhaps, you know, a lot of for what it doesn't say than what it does say. I think, first of all, you know, this does sound all a bit sort of James Bondy. But actually, this is the way that the Russian Secret Service operate. I think it's well known that you know, state-sponsored assassinations are pretty wide and varied. From Alexei Vanyenko, who was poisoned with polonium back in 2006, Sergei Skripal, who was attacked with Novichok, and of course in 2020 when Alex Navalny was attempted assassination using, I'm not sure the right word, but imaginative ways. I mean, this is a unit that doesn't go around shooting people, but seems to use some of the most incredible devices to try and kill people. I think a lot of it is about deniability, or coupled with also putting propaganda and disinformation. You know, similarly, I think we're looking at the Havana Syndrome as well. This is sort of unexplainable. This is not what people are used to looking at. And I'm sure people will say, you know, is this what the British Secret Service and Americans get up to? Well, not in the same vein, but this is absolutely out of the Russian Secret Service playbook. And this group, as called 29155, are well known for it and seem to be picked up, you know, with unerring regularity and detail, almost as though actually having them out there is part of their mystique and terror. Rather than trying to, you know, go under the radar, as it were.
And is it the kind of unit that can move around the world, putting key people where they need to be when they need to be there?
Well, it's like a lot of these things, that the whole diplomatic network does allow people to move agents around the place under, you know, undercover, as it were. I mean, people be aware of what we call the diplomatic bag, where stuff can be moved around without scrutiny. of the country that it's going to. And certainly from the operations of this unit, a lot of it seems to be based around Russian embassies. In this particular case, the main element to it is in Cuba, around Havana. So, I don't think anybody's in any doubt that, you know, this is a state organization that is out there to create mayhem, sabotage, and ultimately to assassinate people who the Russian state don't like.
And the investigators say they found evidence the unit's been experimenting with acoustic or directed radio energy weapons. It's tempting to say that sounds like science fiction, but then so were laser weapons once.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's outside my area of expertise, but I sort of vaguely understand the science. And if you can, you know, affect people, and there seem to be a lot of people who have been quite badly affected by this. Nobody really knows, you know, what it's all about. The CIA and the British, you know, secret intelligence services aren't saying an awful lot about it. It might well be that actually, you know, our security services know an awful lot more than they're letting on at the moment. It is being done in the shadows. It would appear that most of the casualties are FBI and CIA, and nobody really knows how it's done, except that this unit and its members like Mishkin keep appearing on the world stage, which links it back to them.
So do you think this investigation has found the answer to this mysterious Havana syndrome?
I'm not sure. Not sure that we, you know, there are a lot of unanswered questions. And the fact that the US government is not sort of jumping on the back of it, as you would have thought that they might do when their people have been injured. There are probably some reasons that is not happening, but it does seem quite credible. And certainly when you look at the Havana incident itself and the amount of people affected and the information around it, it seems very plausible indeed.
And we also learned this week that a senior Pentagon official suffered symptoms of Havana syndrome at the last NATO summit in Lithuania. Is it really feasible to imagine Russian military intelligence could have got close enough to make some kind of secret weapon like that at a NATO summit?
I find that pretty difficult to understand. I would be very surprised that they could do that. Again, you know, maybe there is sophistication of the weaponry there, but I think we should not underestimate the capabilities of the Russian Secret Service and of this particular unit. Again, I think that is not fully explained, and until one has the details, people will speculate.
And in terms of capabilities, presumably if these kind of acoustic or directed energy weapons have potential and do exist, we'll be working on our own versions.
Entirely. And I'm sure that is part of the reason that we're perhaps hearing less from the authorities than people want for explanation. There is always a game to try and stay one step ahead of your enemy. And if something's been produced, and obviously if we've sorted out an antidote or a counter to it, then best that's kept under wraps rather than allowing your enemies to develop something that gets around it. So, I'm sure that's part of the reason that we are where we are.
Hey, Mr. Bretton Gordon, good to speak to you. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Mike, Hamish is clearly interested in what Western authorities are not saying. It's tempting to turn this into a spy thriller. Is there an intelligence game being played here by the West, or is it just genuine lack of information? What do you think?
No, I think there's a research game being played. You know, we will be interested in this, not necessarily because we want to go around the world doing it, because it's not what we do, it's not our style, but we'll be researching it, I think, to see if it's a genuine weapon. And if so, then you've got to have some way of dealing with it. I mean, Hamish has dealt with, you know, chemical weapons. He's the expert on chemical weapons. And we develop research chemical weapons, not because we want to use them, because we've signed a treaty that we won't, but that we research them so that we will know what is out there and we can deal with it. And, you know, you said in your interview there's some science fiction elements about this, the non-lethal acoustic weapons. Actually, they go back an awful long way, the interest interest in acoustic weapons. And, you know, I remember as a boy seeing a very quite a famous film in about 1960 or 61 called 1-2-3, which Jimmy Cagney. And it was a sort of a comedy thriller about Berlin in the days when there was, before the Berlin Wall went up. That's why I know it was either 60 or 61. It was all about the shenanigans that went on between East and West Berlin. And in that film, somebody is grabbed by the East German border guards and put in a room. They're trying to break him. And the way they break him is playing him a record over and over and over again for hours. And you know, that record was Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Yellow Polka Dot Bikini. And after two hours, he broke and he told them everything. And that was non-lethal acoustic weaponry.
I can see a whole new strand of you delving into your film viewing archive to explain geopolitics, Mike. Thank you so much.
It's a classic. It's a classic Billy Wilder film, 1-2-3.
Lovely. I'll have to watch it now. Thanks to you. And thanks to all of our guests. That is it for now. Professor Michael Clark and I will be back with another SITREP next Thursday. But don't forget, there's an extra edition of the SITREP podcast online now with Tom Much on what he witnessed close to the front line in Ukraine and why morale among the country's troops may have improved in recent months. That's at bfbs.com/SITREP or wherever you get your podcasts. For now, though, from me, Kate Chabot, thank you for listening. Bye-bye.